Bottom Line in Business. Voice America Business. Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, good afternoon. We're coming to you live from Washington, D.C., 12 days until the election. It's one of those beautiful, clean, crisp October days that sort of lets you know fall's in full swing and winter might be just around the corner. So much for Indian summer that was here in Washington last week. We've got a great show for you this afternoon. Got a couple of fine guests. So we're going to lead off with Daryl Nuremberg, a political expert, and take you around the state of the election and also what might be happening in the lame duck. We're going to follow that with one of America's leading oil and gas exploration attorneys, Kyle Parker from Anchorage, Alaska, to talk about exploration issues in the frontier state. And then we're going to have Mark Cowan on to talk about business development, working with the federal government, which might be your best potential customer in a down economic market. And we will conclude with taking your calls and emails to talk a little bit about the election here this year. But we start with Daryl Nuremberg. Daryl is the former chief of staff for Senator Jesse Helms of North Carolina, now the deputy chair of the public policy department here at the law firm of Patton Boggs. Daryl, welcome back to the show. Pleasure to have you again.
Well, thank you, Kevin. Thank you for having me.
Let me ask you very directly, 12 days left, is there anything John McCain can do to pull this election out?
Yes, because keep in mind that the polls right now are very fluid, as the electorate is. And McCain, if you were to believe the polls and looking at the trends, he is the underdog. But that is the position that he likes most and where he operates best, is that in order to win this race, he's going to have to run the table with every one of the swing states. But to do that, he's going to have to do something he's been doing very well for the past week, which is refine, define, and project his message. Second thing he needs to do is spend wisely, because he's involved in the public financing part of presidential elections as opposed to Senator Obama, which gives McCain a limited amount of funds. So he's going to have to be very shrewd as to where he allocates his funds.
He's getting outspent 5 or 6 to 1 in a lot of these battleground states right now.
It is, but if spending money was the only key to victory, then Congress would look a lot different. It's not how much you spend necessarily, it's how you spend it, as long as you have enough to get your message across. And as you can see, Kevin, if you're looking at the tracking polls, there are polls that show the race tightening. And I think that's due to a couple of things. First of all, it shows that the message is getting out and that it's resonating. And second, it's the Republican base and Republican voters who are starting to come home and make their decisions.
Yeah, it'd be very interesting last 10 days here. I mean, are you at all heartened by, as a McCain backer, by the fact that Obama seems to have a history in the primaries of not closing well?
Well, the political professionals will debate as to the reasons why Obama was not closing well in the primaries. Perhaps the most convincing analysis that I had heard was that it wasn't so much that Obama wasn't closing well or that Hillary was closing well. It was just that the undecided voters were actually voters who were not intending to vote for Obama and were just not telling pollsters that they wouldn't vote for Obama. So looking at the undecided voters, that may be the place where you would see the, quote, closing votes.
What would you, if you were working for the Obama campaign, what would you tell them they need to do to close the deal here in the last 12 days?
Well, look, you know, presidential elections are about having a message, having the money to get it out, and the machine to get your folks to the polls. And frankly, I would do precisely what they're doing right now, which is focus on their strengths, which is they have good ground game and get people out and voting early so you get that taken care of and then move on to other voters. Second, continue to raise and spend that money. And third, try to refine the message as they have all along to, you know, since our country is fundamentally a conservative country, to make it clear to the American public is that while there's going to be change, it's a change that you can trust and it's a change that you're going to want.
Well, I want to transition for a minute down from the presidential level to the Senate level, because that seems to be where a lot of the battlegrounds are taking place now and where maybe the real shift for power will occur. Let's start in your own adopted native state there in North Carolina. It seems like Elizabeth Dole's in the fight of her life. How do you assess the state of the race 2 weeks out?
Well, and I appreciate your mentioning the Senate, because that really will be the key element of government in going forward. With the next Congress and the new administration. But keep in mind in North Carolina, it's rare to find a race in that state for Senate that is clear-cut for either the Republican or the Democrat, even up to Election Day. This is a state where each candidate starts out with 45%, and they end up fighting over the 10% in the middle. Senator Dole has proven to be a good campaigner. She's getting her message down right now. But she is running into a headwind, and the headwind is that no one's real certain as to how much of a ground game the Democrats are going to have and how much turnout they're going to produce for Democratic voters. So she may be subject to trends above and beyond her race. The second is that has been a very expensive race in terms of the amount of money that the Democrats have put in. And so she's had to counter that. She was a little slow to respond this summer, but, you know, in the last week or so has really gotten her footing. At the end of the day, whether she comes back or not could well be determined by forces outside of her control, which is the larger national wave.
Interesting. Hey, Darrell, we've been joined by another great colleague on the Democratic side, Stephanie Peters. Stephanie, welcome to the show. We're talking about the state of the Senate races, and Darrell's had his chance to speak his piece, and so I want to ask you, what do the Democrats view as their greatest pickup opportunities just 12 days out from the election in the United States Senate?
Well, before I talk about the Senate races, I wanted to pick up quickly, because I know our time is limited, on Darrell's point about the national trend. And I just think that it's an extremely exciting time when you look at the voter registration and what I anticipate as a high voter turnout and early voting in Florida. I was just in Georgia. The lines are very, very long. And I do think the national trend is going to set the tone for the Senate races and congressional races as well.
Yeah, it certainly looks like at least Obama promises to have coattails. Not sure McCain is showing evidence of coattails. But so, Stephanie, let me rewind again. Where do you as a Democrat see the greatest potential, maybe three quick races you see good chance to pick up Republican Senate seats right now?
I think North Carolina, Minnesota, and I know some folks may, as I said, I was just in Georgia, and I do think things look good there as well.
Wow, you think Jim Martin's got a realistic chance to knock off Saxby Chambliss, huh? That would be probably one of the late-breaking shockers of this election if that falls through.
Well, you heard it here first, Kevin, I suppose.
Very good, very good. Well, let me ask you, just down the street, there's a jury that's sitting in deciding the fate of Ted Stevens, who's on trial there. Do you think if they come back with an acquittal this week, Darrell, is that enough to get Senator Stevens reelected 2 weeks from now, or do you think that it's too late at this point?
Well, no, that's certainly a game changer. We do know that this race is being watched, trial is being very watched very closely in the state. Ted Stevens is an institution. If you come up with an acquittal, obviously it's going to have a major impact. As Stephanie had mentioned, though, this is obviously we have a lot of a national trend here. And on one hand, looking at the Senate races, if you look west of the Mississippi, if this is an early night where the victor in the presidential race is declared early, then that's going to affect turnout in those western states. The one exception, however, will be Alaska because of Palin on the ticket. I also think, Kevin, it's important to keep in mind along the lines what Stephanie had said, is that what we're really viewing now is something historic, something that happens once every generation or so, and that's really a election where there's no presumed front-runner coming in. There's no presumed heir apparent in the presidential race. This is the first time since the 1950s. And so this race at the beginning of the cycle started off as one where the American public would have the opportunity to have input as to the direction of our country for a long time to come. And I think that's why you're seeing so much interest and so much early voting.
Let's fast forward to past the election. Stephanie, let's presume the Senate gets to 57 to even maybe 60 Democrats. How does that change how Washington is governed going forward, regardless of who the next president is?
I think the leadership of the Senate is going to be critically important. I think if you look at legislation that came out of the House and went over to the Senate and some of the negotiations that happened there and some of the shaping of particular pieces of legislation, for example, immigration, I do think that there is a good chance on immigration and health care that you can really form some alliances and coalitions will be built so we can move these critical public policy issues forward.
And Daryl, flip side, how much harder does that make things to be in the minority when the majority is that big in the Senate?
Being in the minority in the Senate is never a bad place to be, but it's a relatively good place to be if the other parts of the government are in the other party's hands, because the Senate was designed by the Founding Fathers to be the place where legislation was sat and where the passions of the moment were cooled down. And there's a lot of talk, Kevin, about how 60 votes is the key number. And it really isn't as key as people think, because the reason that you hear 60 votes is because that's the number of senators you need present and voting to cut off a filibuster. A couple things is that it's very rare on those kind of votes, which are called cloture votes, to have 100% participation from a single party. And the reason is because the fault lines in the Senate are more than just partisan. Senators are also lined up based on the regions their states are located in, the industries their states have, and also by their own generations and their own personal backgrounds. So just because you have 60 Democrats or 60 Republicans does not mean that you have carte blanche to go legislate. What it means is that the Senate has always been a place where it's not necessarily the favored policy that gets through. It's policy which is managed best.
Daryl, I'm going to have to cut you off there. We've been joined by Daryl Nuremberg and Stephanie Peters. We'll be back to talk about oil and gas exploration after this break. You're listening to Capital Thinking.
All we talk about is money. Call us toll-free, 866-472-5790, and talk to the experts. We talk money all the time. Voice America Business.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hey, out of my way! Hey.
Welcome to Washington Gridlock. Pat and Boggs' legal team can make sense of it all. We know how Washington works. We've been sorting it out for the past 46 years. We have what it takes. Straight, unfiltered, Pat and Boggs. We deliver the insights you need to stay on top of your game.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Pat and Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Pat and Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The Internet's only all business and financial radio network, Voice America Business. From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattenboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattenboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back to Capital Thinking. I'm Kevin O'Neill, and if there's one thing that voters care about this election season besides the bailout package, it's probably the price of gas at the pump. We've seen a year where oil has soared to record highs, and energy issues have been on the minds of virtually every voter. The Republican Party's based their campaign in large part around the phrase, drill, baby, drill. And yet here in recent weeks, we've seen the price of oil fall significantly. I know it was a lot cheaper to fill up this week than it's been in months. But we're really looking at still the same supply and demand issues that will probably creep back in on us that impacted us earlier this year. So that means whoever the next president is, whoever the next Congress is going to have to finally sit down and implement a comprehensive national energy policy that prepares us for a future of less oil, more alternatives, and perhaps looks at tapping into some of our comprehensive reserves here in the United States. So with us today to talk about perhaps one leading element of that sound national energy policy is Kyle Parker, an energy attorney from Anchorage, Alaska, the frontier state where the women know how to field dress a moose, and I guess that means the men must be very, very afraid of the women. Is that right, Kyle?
Indeed, Kevin. How are you this morning?
I'm great. Well, thank you for joining us from Anchorage. I guess let's start out a little bit by sort of educating the audience. Kyle, everybody hears a lot about the potential that's in Alaska. Can you tell us a little bit about the energy resources that are there and currently coming into the United States, how much oil and gas we get from the frontier state, and then talk a little bit about what's there in the future?
Certainly. Currently out of Alaska, we have one major oil-producing region, and it's up in the very far north of Alaska, an area called the North Slope, and many people probably are familiar with what's known as Prudhoe Bay. That field's been online now since the late 70s and been the major source of supply for the West Coast states. All of the oil that's produced on the North Slope of Alaska runs down the Trans-Alaska Gas or Oil Pipeline to Valdez, where it's put on tankers and then moved to the refineries that are located up and down the West Coast. Fully a fifth of the nation's oil consumption comes from Alaska. So we are supplying a significant part of the nation's current oil demand. We are not supplying any of the nation's gas demands, and we in Alaska are sitting on tremendous natural gas reserves. You're probably familiar with the much discussion about a natural gas pipeline and where that would run and how that would bring the current discoveries of natural gas into the domestic market has been the topic of much discussion over the last several years here in Alaska and even back there in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, let me ask you about the natural gas. We're not getting any from there now. My understanding from listening to the first dude of Alaska, Todd Palin, talk out there on the campaign trail, he's an oil field worker, as you know. He's talked about the fact that, is it true they're actually burning off some natural gas as a byproduct of drilling for oil up there because they don't have a pipeline yet to ship it down to the lower 48?
No, and in fact, early on in the oil fields, natural gas was a waste product from the crude or the hydrocarbon stream that was being produced, and so it was being flared off, but that was stopped many years ago, and the gas on the North Slope is being reinjected into the formation. Now, they do burn off small amounts of gas. They keep them running on what are called safety flares, and that's in the event that they have an unexpected kick of gas out of any of the fields. They're able to flare that off without creating any kind of danger for the workers up there. But that's just a very small amount of gas. Otherwise, both on the North Slope of Alaska and then down in the Cook Inlet Basin, which supplies the domestic Alaska market with gas, all the gas is being reinjected and it's not being wasted. So it's there for
there to be
future gas pipeline.
Tell us a little bit, Kyle, you know, one of the things I think that frustrates a lot of voters out there in the debate about what we should do in a place like Alaska is the conflicting numbers. You know, on the one hand, the people who want to drill say that there is a ridiculously high supply there. On the other hand, the folks who don't want us to tap those resources are saying that what's up there is inconsequential to our total energy needs in the future. What are the facts?
Well, the facts are that when we put on an oil field into production up here, that oil field, the life of that oil field is many years. It's not as though you're producing all the oil out of that field in one shot or in one year. It's just physically not possible to do. Prudhoe Bay is a great example. When they discovered Prudhoe Bay, they determined that there were 20 billion barrels of oil in place. That discovery was in 1968. And originally they were projecting that there was 9 billion barrels of oil that they would actually recover from that 20 billion in place. But over the last 30 years, advances in technology and other actions taken by the companies have resulted in us increasing the production out of that field, the anticipated production out of that field, up now into the mid-teens, the mid and high teens. So Prudhoe Bay is a great example of a development project that has gone on and has been supplying oil resources to the west coast of the United States now for going on over 20 years. So the concept that the oil that we would produce up here would only supply the nation's energy demands for a number of months or years is just not false, or just not correct. That oil would be produced over many years and would be an increment of what would be coming in from other sources around the world. So it is a specious argument, and we in Alaska reject that, and I think the history proves that it is very different how that works.
Yeah, let me ask you about one of my other sort of frustrating things about this debate is everyone talks about the degradation to the environment that could occur by us drilling in a pristine place like Alaska. They never talk about the fact that if we don't get it in Alaska, we're going to get it in the Middle East or in South America, in places where we don't control the environmental safeguards that occur in bringing that oil to market, nor do we control the thousands of miles that it will take to transship it to the United States for refining and delivery. So talk to me a little bit about the environmental controls that the state of Alaska has and the federal government has operating for the fields that we're looking at in the future.
Kevin, over the years, the environmental laws that have been implemented both at the state level and at the federal level are extraordinarily protective of the environment. And the companies have embraced those laws and worked diligently to comply with them. Certainly there have been incidents and issues over the years, but that doesn't take away from the fact that the overwhelming majority of the projects up here have gone off without any problems at all. And I think that your point is a good one from the standpoint of where we are in control, we the United States are in control of the development projects here and regulate the companies that do the work in the state. And it's a much different environment than what you might say in Russia, for example. There are many apocryphal stories about the pipelines in Russia that just leak oil left and right. Well, we don't have that issue in Alaska. The companies maintain the pipelines up here. The Trans-Alaska pipeline system that's maintained by Alyeska is a model for the rest of the world. So your point is a good one, and the United States has done an excellent job, and our regulatory environment is such that the production of our oil and gas resources can be done in an environmentally sound manner, and it is being done in an environmentally sound manner.
Carol, there's one other sort of perception issue I want to talk to you about, and that is what the people of Alaska think about the issue of drilling new oil fields and building perhaps this natural gas pipeline to the lower 48. You know, it seems that in a lot of other states, I'll take Florida, for example, there's a great deal of significant citizen pushback against the idea of drilling offshore and the chance of there being an oil spill that would despoil the great beaches in Florida is one reason a lot of citizens have been against that. My understanding is that people in Alaska are generally in favor of more of this development, in part because it's jobs and in part because it's such a significant portion of your state budget. Can you tell us a little bit about where the average Joe the plumber stands on this in Alaska?
The general public in Alaska overwhelmingly supports continued exploration and development activities up here. And I think one thing that many people in the lower 48 don't understand about Alaska is its immense size. The idea that we in Alaska are developing our environment and turning it into a Newark, New Jersey, for example, is just wrong.
Hey, we've got listeners in Newark. Let's not play Newark now.
Well, I love Newark, New Jersey, and the folks there, but Alaska is a very different place, and the environment in which we're working is much different than I think most people in the United States can understand or comprehend. And we certainly could talk long and a long time about the differences between doing activities here and elsewhere. But to your point, I think that in Alaska, we're used to the oil industry. I mean, it's been around here since the 50s. The oil industry is responsible for us becoming a state. The Congress was rejecting statehood prior to the mid-50s when Marathon Oil and some other oil companies discovered oil in the Cook Inlet Basin and determined that there would be a financial base for funding a state government up here. So people in the state of Alaska understand the oil industry. They've lived with the oil industry for many years, and they accept that oil and gas development, whether it be onshore or offshore, can be done in an environmentally responsible manner. Now, that doesn't take away the fact that there are certainly some opposed to development, but again, overwhelmingly, most people support it.
Kyle, there are so many questions I've got that I want to talk to you about oil and gas exploration there. I see this as really one of the hot button issues for the whole next Congress. I'm going to ask you real quickly, though, if you wouldn't mind coming back another time to continue this conversation. I think it's real important to our voters and listeners to hear more about it. We've been joined by Kyle Parker talking oil and gas exploration. We're going to come back in just a minute and talk about federal marketing. Thanks for listening to Capital Thinking Radio.
Money, money, up-to-date business and financial news. Money, money, call now and get the financial information you need. 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hola.
Konnichiwa.
Bonjour.
Hello.
From Anchorage to Abu Dhabi.
Markaba.
From Denver to Doha.
Ciao.
Patton Boggs makes business transactions the world over.
Oi.
Rely on our insights for your next deal. Patton Boggs, the international business team. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, the house will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
From the stock market floor to your laptop, we are Voice America Business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back to Capital Thinking. I'm Kevin O'Neill. This next segment is to talk a little bit about the opportunity for your company to do some federal marketing. In today's world of financial chaos, you always have a need to find new sources of revenue, and the need to find new markets is probably greater than ever. For many companies, however, that market doesn't have to be in some far-off land or a chance for you to fight with your competitors over a hard-fought market share. In fact, we're going to talk a little bit about how to go after what's probably the world's largest market, and that's doing business with the United States federal government. With us today is Mark Cowan, a partner at the law firm of Patton Boggs. He's a Washington veteran of 30-plus years. Mark served in three presidential administrations, several federal government agencies, worked on Capitol Hill, been an agent with the CIA and a member of the Air Force, so I guess it's fair to say he's been around Washington for quite a while. Since his government service, Mark's worked for numerous corporations in Washington, representing them both at his own firm and here at Patton Boggs. In the 1980s, Mark formed the first federal markets group here in Washington, D.C., helping companies enter the federal marketplace at both the political appointee level and with career folks. Mark, let me welcome you to Capital Thinking, and let me start, I guess, with a big picture question, and that is exactly how large is the federal marketplace and what kind of companies sell their products to the federal government?
Good morning, Kevin. Thanks for having me here to talk about this topic that's particularly important in this time of financial strife. The federal market is an office that an opportunity that a lot of companies overlook. It's hundreds of billions of dollars that the federal market spends every year, year in and year out, of guaranteed dollars. As you've seen in the financial crisis, the federal government does guarantee its money, that it spends on literally everything. Think about almost everything that you use in the household, that you use in the market, that you use in any way possible. Everything from fighter aircraft to pins and needles to food products to services, pencils, T-shirts, computers, accounting services, guard dogs, temporary help services, almost anything you want to think about, one agency or another of the federal government buys it. And they buy it from big companies, from little companies, from Indian tribes, from almost everybody.
Mark, we might have to talk after the show about my need to get some guard dogs brought into my own personal compound for my safety. But I want to shift and talk a little bit about big contractor, little contractor. You know, I think most people's perception is that you only have large companies like a Lockheed or Honeywell that can sell to the government. If I'm a smaller company, how do I get into the marketplace to sell my products to the federal government?
Well, Kevin, having heard your show many times, you may need more than guard dogs, but as you said, we can talk about that after the show. It's a good question, Kevin, and there's really lots of ways to get into the federal market. It depends a lot on on what you sell, and the scope of the show probably doesn't allow us to go into great detail, and someone getting to the federal market needs help getting to the federal market and needs to look into it. But a short answer would be, if you're selling a commodity a product, something the federal government buys a lot of, like shoes or pins and needles or pencils, something that can be easily described in shorthand, those products are often bought through what's called the General Services Administration. That's the federal buyer, in effect, the agency that does the buying for the federal government. And there's a list of the General Services Administration that through various forms and applications, a small business or a large business can get on those lists, and then different federal agencies buy off that list. Now, I'm oversimplifying it, but that's the short version. There's also the Small Business Administration that's helped small businesses in getting into the federal market. There are also programs for minority businesses to get in the federal market. There are also ways to get in the federal market as subcontractors to large businesses. Large businesses have requirements to use subcontractors, both minority and otherwise. And then, of course, there's firms like Patton Boggs and other firms that help businesses get into the federal market in a myriad of ways.
Mark, I know one of the key questions as people look out at the financial landscape has got to be the federal government is spending literally trillions of dollars now to prop up the financial sector. Is there actually going to be money left at the end of the day to spend on the normal products in the procurement process, or is that money this money in the financial market going to take away from what these companies could look for in a relationship with the federal government?
That's a good question, Kevin. And no, I think that's just adding to the pie. And in fact, this money that the federal government is pumping into the market to stabilize the economy is just more money going into the federal market. This money is going into banks. It's going into the market to help banks lend money to people, to buy more houses, to buy more cars, to buy more services, to spend more money. So it just enhances the federal market. But that's not going to stop the military from spending. It's not going to stop Health and Human Services from spending. It's not going to stop the Veterans Administration from buying uniforms for doctors, from buying syringes and needles, from buying medicines, from buying cars and trucks and everything they need. It's not going to stop the federal government from building highways and bridges. There's probably going to be more of that to stimulate the economy. I think the government is going to have to do more stimulating the economy, which means, in fact, spending more money.
Now, Mark, you mentioned the Defense Department there, and my perception would be the Defense Department is probably the largest of the federal agencies that you could have a relationship with. But I was wondering if you could talk us through who some of the biggest agencies in the federal government are, where the best source of dollars is for people looking to sell things to the feds.
That's an excellent question, Kevin, and that begs the question of how you enter the market, and that's a little bit why we advise companies to get some help before they rush pell-mell into the federal market, because the first thing you need to do is assess the market, and assess the market in terms of your products and services. What do you have to sell, and who in the government would be most likely to buy it? The Defense Department, you're quite right, is the largest buyer of products and services. Not surprisingly, they have the largest budget. But there's lots of other places that buy products and services as well, everything from Food and Drug Administration, to the Department of Agriculture, to HHS, the VA, the Veterans Administration, which a lot of people wouldn't think of as a huge buyer of products and services. CIA buys products and services. They may be somewhat odd, night division devices, for example, but they buy products and services. So you really have to look at what you sell and who buys it, and there are firms that will help you do that.
Mark, what about being a foreign company? Does that impact at all your ability to work with the federal government and have a sales relationship with them?
It does. If you're a Cuban company, you're probably not going to do very well in selling to the no cigars to the military. And if you want Cuban cigars, you probably have to be a smuggler. Other than that, though, being a foreign company only has certain ramifications. Many foreign companies are relatively free to sell to the federal government. There is a Buy American Act, but it only impacts certain products from certain companies. Most foreign products are relatively free to sell to the federal government, and most foreign companies can do very, very well in the federal marketplace as long as they know the rules. For example, NATO companies from NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, companies can sell pretty well anywhere to the federal government, including to the Department of Defense. companies from countries that are part of NAFTA, of course, have wide-ranging ability to sell. Companies that we have free trade agreements with, likewise. So foreign companies ought to look very hard at the federal government. There are great opportunities for them here. And they need help in doing it, because not only are they selling to the U.S. government, but they're selling into a different culture.
Mark, you mentioned Buy America Act there. I guess I wanted to point out here that there are lots of ways to get a waiver to Buy American requirements in most laws with agencies, and that's also an opportunity for companies to work with somebody like you to figure out whether or not, even if there is a Buy American requirement, whether or not that can be waived in instances. Well, let's shift. You know, we've got a big election coming up, and we're going to get a new administration, either an Obama administration or a McCain administration. So I wonder if you could walk us through some of the distinctions between working with career officials who make some of these purchasing decisions and working with people who are political appointees of the new administration.
There's an important distinction to be made there. When we work with companies, we recommend what we call a top-down, bottom-up approach. And what we mean by that is you need to work with both. Career employees, of course, are called that because they're there for a career, and they basically run the agencies and run the mechanisms, the mechanics of government, and make the day-to-day decisions in government. And if you're selling to the government, you need to establish and maintain strong relationships with those people. Their buying motivation is, of course, well-motivated and to get good products for the government, but they also have a certain risk aversion. If they don't know you, if they're not comfortable with you, if you're a new entrant in the market, they're by definition and understandably going to be a little bit shy about doing business with you, and that's going to put you at somewhat of a disadvantage over well-known long-term sellers of products. On the other hand, political appointees, those people who head the agencies, who are appointed by the president, who come in to run things, are there for a finite period of time. And their motivation, as you can see from this current campaign, they're coming in to make change. They're coming in to make things different, to make things better. Whether they do or not, that's what they think they're going to do, and they're going to be there for a period of time, for a year, for 2 years, at the most for 4 years. Maybe they win a second election, but in their mind they're there for 4 years. Therefore, they want to do things quickly. So their motivation is different, and therefore the approach to them is by definition different. And when you're selling, you have to recognize that in your sales approach to these two different bodies, and it's important to think about that as you're making your sales plan, and it's important to approach both groups in your sales program.
Mark, I think we've got time for one more quick question, and I guess for this is really for our listeners. If they want to get some information or help from you, where do they go to find out more about federal marketing opportunities?
There are a number of places you can go. The Small Business Administration is a good place to go. The General Services Administration has some online services. The Government Printing Office has some brochures and pamphlets to get you started. Your local congressman's office may be helpful. In the end, you're probably going to want some consulting services and someone on board to help you specifically and purposefully with your own program.
Mark, really appreciate you joining us for this segment to talk about federal marketing. I think it's important. A lot of companies don't realize how to navigate through the process and what are some of the key checkpoints, and it sounds like you've done a good job of outlining that for us. Listeners, if you're interested in finding out more information from Mark Cowan, here's his email address, mcowan, M-C-O-W-A-N, at pattenbogs.com. You can also call Mark directly at 202-457-6401. Thanks for listening to Capital Thinking. We'll be back with more in just a moment.
Stocks, bonds, 401ks, investments, refinancing. We can help you. Call now toll free, 866-472-5790, 866-472-5790. Voice America Business.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The bottom line in business. Voice America Business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, we're back on Capital Thinking. This is Kevin O'Neill. We're back for what I'll call the lightning round, talking a little bit about some of the key issues in the election and the impact of the election. You want to jump in with a phone call, pick up your phone and call us at 866-472-5790. Again, 866-472-5790. Happy to talk to you with your questions about the election. Got an email during the show from one of our listeners. A shout out to Coop out in Los Angeles, who's listening to us early in his workday there. And Coop's question is basically what impact the Colin Powell endorsement Sunday of Barack Obama will have on this election. And he's got a sub-question there sort of asking what would that endorsement have happened if Condoleezza Rice had been John McCain's running mate. I want to talk about those kind of in reverse order, Coop. Condoleezza Rice is probably the most qualified woman to be on a national ticket, given that she's been Secretary of State and the National Security Advisor in a time of war, and has got significant diplomatic experience, which seems to be one of the key things that will be important to being president or vice president at any time in our past or in our future. But, of course, when you've got a candidate, John McCain, who's spending most of his time on the stump, basically talking about how he's not George Bush and openly attacking George Bush because that's your best route to winning this election, it's hard to see how McCain could have ever had a justification to pick Condoleezza Rice, even though it would have potentially given him outreach not just to working women and not just to moderates who probably have a pretty decent opinion of Condi Rice despite all that's going on in the Bush administration, but maybe even an opening to claw back some of those percentages of African Americans. Remember, Bush won, I believe, in the 20% range in 2004, and McCain's looking to win somewhere around 2% of African American votes in this election. But what impact did Colin Powell have on the people that are undecided? Most of the polls have about 1 in 10 voters still undecided. I suspect it didn't have a lot of impact, and I suspect that Colin Powell wasn't looking to have a big impact on the race, even though he went out and endorsed at this stage. You have to remember that the Obama folks have been courting Colin Powell pretty hard for a while now. There were rumors that he would be a surprise guest speaker at the Democratic National Convention in Denver. That, of course, did not materialize. But had he spoken there, he would have had a bully pulpit. He would have had a multiple audience over what watches Meet the Press on a Sunday morning. And that would have really dampened the impact a week later of Joe Lieberman taking the stage at the Republican National Convention and crossing the aisle to endorse his friend John McCain. So I think Colin Powell probably realized that he wanted to endorse Obama quite a while ago, and he picked this as the route to do it so that it had an impact, but so that it didn't potentially, it wasn't a game changer, if you will, for the election. He's been very careful about his position here. And it's very interesting. I mean, he waited until Obama was up significantly in the polls so that he couldn't be seen as the difference maker in putting Obama over the top. Now, I got another question, too, about the state of Obama's cabinet and who we think might be in that cabinet. And while we're starting to see a lot of names bandied about, there were some articles this weekend about transition. There's some articles today about Obama being hard at work planning his transition. And McCain is as well. That's the right thing to do. It's not just assuming you're going to win. It's preparing to win. It's very important. I'll say this. Obama is going to have a superstar cabinet, probably the best cabinet that we've seen in Washington in some time, certainly at least since the start of the Bush administration in 2000, when there was a great pent-up demand to have a lot of very seasoned Republican governors come to town and serve as cabinet officials and bring their ideas to bear there. With Obama, you've got a great pent-up demand amongst Democrats to fill these senior-level positions, having not had the opportunity to do so in 8 years. You've got some people at the Senate level who are at the Senate level and at the governor's level who are cycling out of their careers there and ready to take on a different challenge. He's going to have his pick of those folks, a real deep bench, I think. And with a sharply Democratic Senate, you're going to have a quick confirmation process, which means less angst. There'll be less digging into your background, and I think that will be attractive to a lot of good people. So I think you'll see a lot of big names. Despite the fact Obama is running on a message of change, I think you're likely to see a roster made up primarily of governors and senators who will move into the first round of his cabinet, his senior cabinet folks. Another question that's come in is about who's going to take over leadership of the House if, as expected, we see a bloodbath in 12 days and Republicans lose even more seats than they lost 2 years ago. Right now, my guess is that Republicans are looking realistically at losing 25 to maybe even 40 seats in the House of Representatives. I was looking at some news this morning that talked about the Republicans pulling their advertising, their third-party advertising, in a lot of House races where they thought they had a chance, and now they're just playing defense in a small handful of races where they still have some money left. I think you will see a dramatic turnover in the House leadership. There simply will have been too many seats lost in 2006 and 2008 for the Republicans to stand pat with the team of John Boehner and Roy Blunt, and I think you'll see a very significant and deliberate generational shift to leaders who are in no older than their early 50s, I suspect, people who can be in leadership for a while, because I think Democrats have a pretty good hold on the House of Representatives for the foreseeable future. If they pick up 40 seats, they're looking at having, let me do the math here, roughly about a 70-seat majority in the House of Representatives. That's going to take a couple of election cycles to turn over. Let's end by talking a little bit about the Senate. We talked earlier in the show about sort of the magic number needed to run that place, not being 60, but Daryl Nuremberg, our guest, mentioned perhaps being lower, 57 or so, to actually effectively run. The Democrats think they can pick up one or two or even three Republicans on any given issue to get to that magic number of 60 and cut off debate and proceed to a vote on underlying pieces of legislation. As we look here 12 days out, I think there are at least three virtual locks for the Democrats to pick up. That's Virginia and New Mexico, where those guys are already measuring the drapes and hiring their office staff because they know they're going to win. That's Tom Udall in New Mexico and Mark Warner in Virginia. They're going to win big double-digit victories in both states. They're looking at, by my count, seven states is very likely to pick up: New Hampshire, North Carolina, Minnesota, Oregon, Alaska, that all depends on the trial in Colorado, and then possibles in Georgia and Maine. And so I think you're going to see just a huge opportunity for the Democrats to come in and push a very bold agenda right out of the gate. You won't see the usual differences between House and Senate will get ironed out very quickly in the first 90 days of this Congress, and you'll see some major pieces of legislation float through. We're going to spend all of October and November talking about those major pieces, but we'll be back next week on Capital Thinking. Join us again here on the Voice America Business Network for our next episode.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.